No work too hard for him. That's quite a statement, isn't it? And be still and let the power of the Lord work. And that's hard to do sometimes because I kind of like to get involved and fix things, don't you? Hard to be quiet. I put in your notes, many of us relate to Habakkuk in his feeling that God at times appears to be silent. Have you ever said in your prayer life, man, I just pray and wait and pray and listen and it seems like he doesn't respond to me? And it's helpful to remember at those times that God understands our human perspective, welcomes our questions, and it's important to remain confident that God is still present when we do not get his response when we desire it. He always answers, he always is faithful, and he's never ahead of schedule or behind schedule, but patiently waiting sometimes can be a challenge. So appreciate the worship team and the great work that they do. And delighted for the young people added, and we're blessed and we're gifted here for what we get to enjoy. In these next few minutes, let's look at the book of Habakkuk. We're coming down towards the end of these minor prophets, these shorter ones. And I think that it's good to remember that it's a lot like Job, these opening statements. Job had that question, kind of God, what's going on? And we know the whole story of Job, but Job did not know why what was happening to him was happening. In fact, there's no indication in the book that he was ever told what it was all about. We hope that he was, but we don't know. And the writer of Psalm 73 is another one who says, I just about lost perspective. I almost crashed in my faith until I came into the house of the Lord, and then I understood the big picture. He was caught up with seeing how that evil people seemed to get away with their evil, and then he realized that he had a short perspective and that God has the final say in all of this judgment. There is a finality to it, as Tim so well pointed out. So as you come to Habakkuk, and I'm reading from the New Living Translation because I can understand it better than some of the others. And if you don't have that particular one, you might want to listen rather than trying to keep up in your own Bible, but that's up to you. The first question asked is, why don't you answer me? Habakkuk is complaining. How long, O Lord, must, this verse 2, how long, O Lord, must I call for help? But you do not listen. Now that's quite a statement to make to God, don't you think? Hey, God, how long do I have to call on you, and why don't you listen? That probably goes on between husbands and wives occasionally. How many times do I have to ask you, but you don't seem to be listening? I know what that sounds like. I know what that feels like. I've earned every bit of it. And God can handle that. I don't think it's a sinful request. I think it's a heart cry that says, God, I need help. Violence, I cry, but you do not come to save. If this sounds a little bit like the Oregonian and the late night news, guess what? We're kind of in the same condition on this old planet. Verse 3, must I forever see this sin and misery all around me? Wherever I look, I see destruction and violence. I am surrounded by people who love to argue and fight. The law has become paralyzed and useless, and there is no justice given in the courts. The wicked far outnumber the righteous, and justice is perverted with bribes and trickery. That sounds very current to me. This is 2,000, maybe 26, 700 years ago. Human nature has a problem when it gets out of line and out of step with Creator God. Doesn't matter when it is, where it is, that's just the way we are, and we need God's holiness and his presence to pull us into line. So Habakkuk is looking around, and he's seeing his own people fall away from God, and he's seeing unbelievable destruction and evil from the heathen nations, and he's crying out to God, and he doesn't seem to get an answer. And so he finally gets one in verse 5, and I don't think it's the one he was looking for. The Lord replied, look at the nations and be amazed. Watch and be astounded. I think I'll read it off of this page that I can see a little better. For I am doing something in your own day, something you wouldn't believe even if someone told you about it. I'm raising up the Babylonians, a cruel and violent people. I don't think he wanted to hear that. Habakkuk understood what the Assyrians were doing, and he wanted them put out of the way. And so he cries out to God and says, everything is falling apart, and you don't seem to answer. God says, I'll answer. Let me tell you what, it's going to get worse. Not probably what he wanted to hear. I am raising up the Babylonians, a cruel and violent people. They will march across the world and conquer other lands. They are notorious for their cruelty and do whatever they like. Their horses are swifter than cheetahs and fiercer than wolves at dusk. And it goes on and on until you're just shriveling, shaking in what's really happening. And finally in verse 11 it says, they sweep past like the wind and are gone, but they are deeply guilty for their own strength is their God. Now that should be good for Habakkuk to hear that. That should be good for him to hear that, because he's seen the awfulness of his own nation. Now he's hearing God say that another nation is going to come in and be even more brutal and devastating than the Assyrians. He needs to remember that it's temporary and that these people are guilty. Their strength is not in Creator God. And their days are numbered. And so in verse 12, you have his second request. And I called it, if you don't answer me, can I trust you? Now he's got a problem with, can I really trust God? Because this thing doesn't seem to be adding up to me the way it should. And it's a problem of comparison. And I'll conclude in the life lessons that this is always a dangerous thing to do, to get into the comparison mode. That person's worse than I am, so I ought to get some special favor. That's kind of what he's saying. Verse 12, O Lord, my God, my Holy One, who is you who are eternal, surely you do not plan to wipe us out. O Lord, our rock, you have sent these Babylonians to correct us, to punish us for our many sins. But you are pure and cannot stand the sight of evil. Will you wink at their treachery? Should you be silent while the wicked swallow up people more righteous than they? Isn't that an interesting spot to be in? I have my own issues. I need to clean up my act. And I need to submit to God and let him do that. But instead of that, I look around and I say, hey, have you seen those other people over there? They're more messed up than I am. They're more wicked than I am. In comparison to them, I'm not doing so bad. Verse 14. Speaking of his fellow Israelites, are we only fish to be caught and killed? Are we only sea creatures that have no leader? Must we be strung up on their hooks and caught in their nets while they rejoice and celebrate? Then they will worship their nets and burn incense in front of them. These nets are the gods, little g, who have made us rich, they will claim. Will you let them get away with this forever? Will they succeed forever in their heartless conquests? This guy is really hurting. He's reflecting on the devastation that has come and punishment to his own people. And now he's hearing, when he feels like God is really not answering him, he's hearing that it's going to be more of it and even worse. And he's saying, come on. We're messed up in Israel, but we're your people. And compared to those evil people, we're kind of righteous. And it's really troubling him. He's not comfortable with it at all. And finally, in chapter 2, verse 1, he says, I will climb up to my watchtower and stand at my guard post. There I will wait to see what the Lord says and how he will answer my complaint. Now, I don't know if this is fair or not, so you just take it from me and then you figure it out on your own and forget what I said. But I kind of picture this Habakkuk. He's really hurting, genuinely hurting. He's really frustrated. He's feeling lonely. He wants to believe, but he's having trouble believing. He's not getting the information from God that he really wants. And he really is wrestling with his faith. Do I really trust God to pull this thing off the way I believe he wants to pull it off? And as he works through this, I climb up in my high tower. He kind of just sits back in his corner and folds his arms and says, I think I'll just wait and see how this turns out. And you can interpret into that anything you want to. But when I'm honest, I identify with that. When I see things so out of line and they don't seem to get corrected and God really doesn't move as quickly as I think he should, I don't want to mistrust him, but I don't know what to do with it. And I find myself just kind of, I guess I'll just wait. There's a good side to that. It can also be a dangerous side, I think. And he gets a very interesting answer. I won't read it all in chapter 1, or chapter 2, verse 2 up to 19. Then the Lord said to me, love this next phrase, this next line, write my answer plainly on tablets so that a runner can carry the correct message to others. So write it down and then send it out with a runner to tell everybody. I think that's the original Facebook. It goes a lot faster today. You don't have to put it on a parchment and have somebody run around and tell everybody. You just put it on Facebook and the world knows it. It would have been a lot easier for God to get his message out back then if he'd had Facebook, don't you think? I'm glad he didn't. I'm not sure I'm glad that we have it today. This vision is for future time. It describes the end and it will be fulfilled. If it seems slow in coming, wait patiently. Isn't that just exciting counsel? For it will surely take place. It will not be delayed. And then he goes on to describe these people that are going to be judged. Look at the proud, verse 4. They trust in themselves, and their lives are crooked, but the righteous will live by their faithfulness to God. Wealth is treacherous, and the arrogant are never at rest. They open their mouths as wide as the grave. Verse 6, but soon their captives will haunt them. And it goes all the way down to where you get down to about verse 13, and it describes the future judgment of people who ignore God. And it's God saying to Habakkuk, you're troubled with timing. It's not happening as fast as you think it should happen, and you're caught up in your own perspective. And let me just broaden that picture a little bit to let you know that these people that are hurting you, because I need to let them hurt you because you're not walking with God either, they have a destruction ahead of them that you will know nothing about because you'll be ultimately redeemed. And so in verse 14, for as the waters fill the sea, the earth will be filled with an awareness of the glory of the Lord. Sorrow waits the wicked people, but there's better days for Israel. You will have to wait and see that happen. In verse 18, what good is an idol carved by man? That would be the worship experience of these heathens. Or a cast image that deceives you? How foolish to trust in your own creation, a God that can't even talk. What sorrow awaits you who say to wooden idols, wake up and save us, to speechless stone images who say, rise up and teach us. Can an idol tell you what to do? They may be overlaid with gold and silver, but they are lifeless on the inside. I believe that whole thing is simply God saying to Habakkuk, broaden your vision of things, get a perspective. God is not done. God really isn't silent, but you're trying to rush things, and God is on his own timetable. Which brings us to the third point, God is still God, and it's one key verse, chapter 2, verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. You realize that the day will come when all evil will be gone. There will be no presence of anything evil. And the entire family of God will worship the Lord in whatever the holy temple is, the expanse of it. And the earth will be silent before him. And all will know who he is. That's what we have to look forward to. You know, we try to figure out what heaven's like, and that's okay, all of that. But really, to just be in the presence of God, away from evil, and everything is focused on him and everything is perfect, that's enough description of heaven for me. Is it for you? I don't need to have a bunch of questions answered. I don't need to know a lot of details. You know, it's a big old universe. Heaven's probably all over the place out there. But the big thing is that heaven is where God is. Heaven is where God is. We know that in our human relationships. If there's someone we love and that really means everything to us, then when we're with them, everything's okay. Everything's okay. When we're with God, everything will be okay. And that's about as big a description of heaven as satisfies me. Then in chapter 3, you have his prayer. And it's really in three parts. I'll outline it for you. You can read most of it on your own. This prayer was sung by the prophet Habakkuk. I have heard all about you, Lord. I am filled with awe by your amazing works. In this time of our deep need, help us again as you did in the years gone by, and in your anger, remember your mercy. I see God moving across the deserts from Edom, the Holy One coming from Mount Paran. His brilliant splendor fills the heavens, and the earth is filled with his praise. His coming is as brilliant as the sunrise. Get a mental picture of that. Rays of light flash from his hands where his awesome power is hidden. Pestilence marches before him. Plague follows close behind. When he stops, the earth shakes. When he looks, the nations tremble. He shatters the everlasting mountains and levels the eternal hills. He is the Eternal One. That's who God is. He says, I've heard this, and I know this, and this is what I'm aware about him. And then in the next part of it, he talks more in the present. Verse 7, I see the people of Cushan in distress and the nation of Midian. And he talks about how God has, through the years, dealt with them as he's protected the Israelites and brought them through many experiences, reflecting on a lot of the Old Testament. And he says, when I look at all of this, verse 15, you trampled the sea with your horses and the mighty waters piled high. I trembled inside when I heard this. My lips quivered with fear. My legs gave way beneath me, and I shook in terror. He says, when I think about everything you've done, God, you've been in control all along. You've conquered evil. I shouldn't be questioning anything that you're doing or not doing. It's been an amazing journey. And so it basically said, I'll remember that. I've heard about it, and I'll remember it. And then it comes to the passage in the end of 16. I will wait quietly for the coming day when disaster will strike the people who invade us. I will wait quietly. That might be the strongest advice of this book. We need to learn to wait quietly, or as we sang, to be still and know that God is God. And it's obvious that as Habakkuk starts his letter, he's struggling with that. He's not waiting quietly. He's tired of waiting. He's noisy. He's kind of hollering at God. He's saying, why in the world can't you answer me and do something? And he gets a simple answer, really, in summary. Habakkuk, be quiet. Wait patiently. I know what I'm doing. Just trust me. I see it over and over again in the Bible, the most powerful words he gives to us. He says, don't be afraid. Just trust me. It's throughout the scriptures. And so, he basically is saying, so I'll wait quietly. I'll wait patiently. Verse 17, if everything is falling apart, if everything is failing, and all the evidence around me looks like you're not there anymore, God, and that you don't care, I'll still trust you. Even though the fig trees have no blossoms, there's no grapes on the vines, and the olive crop fails, the fields lie empty and barren, even though the flocks die in the fields, and the cattle barns are empty, even though it's all negative, and I don't know what's going on, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. When we can come to that point, we have a sense of confidence and peace and joy that you can't really explain. You just know that it's happening. And he says, I'll be joyful in the God of my salvation. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes me as sure-footed as a deer, able to tread upon the heights. It's an amazing statement that some of that was even quoted by Mary when she found out that she was going to be the earthly mother of Jesus and gave that magnificent statement. There's a few lines that are in her prayer. So I drew some life lessons out of this. Number one, we do not need to feel God's presence in order to enjoy him. Now, I am very well aware that personality plays in the way we feel about the closeness of God, and I respect that. Some of us are kind of a little more logical, a little more cold, a little more calculated, and we don't need a lot of feeling in our relationship to God. It doesn't mean we we're any less close to him. It's just who we are. We kind of do life that way. And the plus side of that is that sometimes we're able to handle some issues without getting overly emotional. The downside of it is that sometimes we're not too tender and we're not too sensitive to people who really need to feel things. The other personality is, man, they just feel everything. I mean, they're just fuzzy and fluffy and emotional and wonderful. And if they don't really have more of a feeling, they wonder if somebody even really cares about them. So to say to them, I love you, they hear the words, but they probably need a touch or some physical evidence that really demonstrates to them that that's the case. And I think when it comes to God, we need to respect that, but we also, all of us, whether we're the feeling touchy kind or the less sensitive kind, we need to realize that the presence of God isn't determined by how we feel. Feeling can be very dangerous. We can feel things that are phony. And I think Habakkuk was needing to feel the presence of God in a way that he wasn't feeling it. And God said to him, it's not about your feeling, it's about my facts. I believe that's the message he was trying to get to him. And I think that's a good thing to review and to evaluate in light of our personality, because everything we do in our life runs through the grid of who we are. We do not need to feel God's presence in order to enjoy him. If we don't feel like he's close, it doesn't necessarily mean that he moved. It might mean that we moved away from him, and that's another whole issue. If God isn't acting the way we think he should act, it doesn't mean that he's not close by in charge doing what he's supposed to do. It may feel awful, but he's not awful. He hasn't messed up. He hasn't made a mistake. So we need to be careful about our feelings. And I think Habakkuk reminds us of that. He was feeling like God had just kind of stepped aside and left him alone, and that he needed to kind of get God's attention. And God says, hey, Habakkuk, I know what's going on. You don't need to tell me anything. I'm in charge. I got it all figured out, and I'll do it my way. Secondly, comparisons are dangerous. Do not put God in a box. And I think this idea of look at them and look at me, and I think I'm better than they are, so therefore I should get some special favor. That's a dangerous thing to do if we're not doing what we ought to be doing. If I'm messing around with sin that doesn't seem to be as huge an impact as this person over here is that's having a big impact, it's pretty stupid of me to say, you know what, in light of them, I'm not so bad. What I need to say is, I got an issue here and I need to deal with it. And when Habakkuk said, hey, God, I know we've messed up, but those people have messed up really bad. Why do you let them get away with it? And God says, hey, I won't let them get away with it. I got that one figured out. But you guys need to get your act together. Comparisons can be dangerous. Don't put God in a box. We need to deal with our own issues. It's good to remember, number three, that evil gets judgment eventually. God is still God. God is still God. If we need to say that out loud, if we need to write it on a page, if we need to put it on Facebook, if we need to write it on a pad and send a runner out with it, God is still God. We need to remember that. He always has been, he always will be, and he has the final say. And then number four is very convicting to me, but I think it's very important. Joy-filled waiting on God is an aspect of worship. I think of worship with this amazing worship team and singing songs and lifting our praises. I think of worship as prayer. I think of worship as study. I think of worship as doing life, walking with God. But waiting? Waiting with a heart full of joy? Worship? Yeah. That's what it says. That's what it says. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. Life is falling apart, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in the God of my salvation. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He will make me as sure-footed as a deer and bring me safely over the mountains. I think the counsel to me in that one is the steadfast love of the Lord never fails. So, Bill, just be patient and quietly worship me when it looks like everything is falling apart. Father, I want to do that. I work hard at trying to just hush and know that you're God. But I'm quick to admit that patient waiting in my heart often does not come out as joyful worship. So thanks for being patient and for the journey that continues to grow. Thanks for the reminder. Thank you that you're still God. I so love you today, and I appreciate that confidence. All because of Savior Jesus, who took care of the sin problem when he died on the cross and rose again to be our eternal Savior. Thank you. In his name, amen.